This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swohib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
there's problems with transparency that are both institutionalized in the Malian kind of democratic system, but also there's anti-transparency practices.
That's Jonathan Sears, an assistant professor at Menno Simons College, who has been following Mali's election process. Details coming up.
Also, Nelson Chamisa's Zimbabwe opposition MDC alliance files a court challenge to the July 30th elections. And the government in Cameroon is trying to negotiate an end to the crisis between people displaced by Boko Haram and villagers who have hosted them for the past 3 years.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Zimbabwe's opposition MDC alliance just a few hours ago filed its court challenge to the July 30th elections. Nelson Chamisa, the alliance's presidential candidate, tweeted, "We have a good case and a good cause," after the legal team arrived at the court. The opposition argues there was election fraud and that the ruling ZANU-PF party's candidate, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, did not win. While the alliance legal team was heading to court today, one of its leaders also was before a judge for a second day. Yesterday, Tendai Biti was charged with inciting violence. Today, Biti, president of the People's Democratic Party, argued he could not be tried in Harare because he was brought to the country illegally. He alleges Zambian officials violated international law in denying his request for asylum and sending him back to Zimbabwe yesterday. Journalist Kudzai Zvinivashi was at the court in Harare with Biti. He spoke with Alec Mucha Dehama, one of Biti's lawyers.
Yeah, in fact, as you might know, Mr. Biti was challenging the authority of the Zimbabwean court to try him, given the circumstances under which he was brought back to Zimbabwe, which was basically that he was abducted from Zambia and brought unlawfully into the country. When the Zambian court had made it clear that he was supposed to appear before the Zambian court so that the issue of his asylum is determined. But before that could be determined, the authorities in Zambia, acting together with those in Zimbabwe, then abducted him from Zambia and took him back to Zimbabwe. And the law says that you cannot be tried by any court if the basis upon you being in that country is unlawful. So we're challenging that. So we led evidence from Mr. Tendai Biti, and the matter is still continuing to the extent that the state also wants to lead their own evidence. So the matter is continuing on Wednesday, the 15th of August.
Biti crossed into Zambia on Wednesday, but Zambian officials handed him back to Zimbabwe police Thursday morning. After spending hours in court today, Biti told journalists he thinks he will win the case.
Well, I think that we exposed the truth, and you can hide the truth, and we hope that Zambia and Zimbabwe can be held accountable for failing to protect people's rights.
He was charged with inciting public violence last week and with illegally announcing that Nelson Chamisa had won the election. The court freed him on bail. Zimbabwe authorities say that announcement led to the protest, which resulted in police shooting 6 demonstrators dead. Friday's court challenge postpones Mnangagwa's inauguration scheduled for Sunday. The court has 14 days to rule.
In Mali, 2 veteran politicians face off in a runoff presidential election on Sunday. Last week, President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita won 41% of the vote against 24 candidates, including second place Soumyala Cissé, who earned 17%. The poll was controversial. Over half of the 24 candidates called for the resignation of the minister in charge of elections. there were allegations of ballot box stuffing, and officials say that 767 polling stations were closed because of security issues in large parts of the conflict-plagued central and northern regions. Jonathan Sears is an assistant professor of international development studies at Menno Simons College, an affiliate of the University of Winnipeg in Manitoba, Canada, and does research for the Center of Francophonie at the University of Quebec in Montreal. He's been following the polls in Mali and talked to reporter William Eagle about the controversial vote.
There's problems with transparency that are both institutionalized in the Malian kind of democratic system, but also there's anti-transparency practices. So all that's deeply concerning, and it, in a way, kind of reinforces the positive and the negative from my point of view.
What are some of the positives?
Malians, according to the figures I've seen in terms of participation rates, it's the highest participation in a presidential election except for 2013. It was like in the low 40s, which granted is low by African standards, but by Malian standards, this is the second highest participation rate in Malian presidential election history. Notwithstanding all of the conditions, the questions of insecurity, the accessibility of voter cards, you know, the people's suspicion as to whether or not their vote would be counted or whether it would be, you know, in a ballot box that ended up getting stuffed or stolen or burned, right? So notwithstanding everything that Malians understand intimately about the flawed nature of the democratic process in their country, they still went out and voted in very significant numbers, even in some cases, I'm sure, at a sense of the risk of their lives.
The two leading candidates who go to the polls in a runoff this Sunday come from a similar background. Of the two men that are facing each other this Sunday, did they campaign on differing programs? Did they have a different vision of the country?
You've asked the question, and this is the challenge. I mean, I spoke with the former prime minister on this issue, and it's a real challenge, and I think you saw it throughout the campaign, and I think we could see this being sharpened a little bit, that the candidates really are very light on programmatic alternatives. There's a lot of, I want to do all the good things that the previous guy failed to do, and I'm not him, so you should, you know, vote for me. The inability of Malian politicians at the elite level, but also even at the legislative level, to really hear and understand and connect with voters and citizens' preoccupations in a way of converting that into political capital. It's very poor. And I think we see that in the sort of the lack of clear and clearly distinguishable social political programs. The other thing I'd say about the Malian case is sort of the hollowing out of the party system, if you will, under Amadou Toumani Touré, who ran as an independent, and sort of the state of disarray, if you will, that the Malian political party system is in. You know, notwithstanding the kind of establishment, you know, the historic parties, they're able to mobilize people, I guess, and under party banners, but because of the necessity of coalitions and kind of those sorts of negotiations, the idea that different parties really represent credible and clearly distinguishable alternatives is just not there.
Under the current president, the economy has grown 5%. Is that enough to perhaps sway people to continue voting for him?
The economic gains will be and are concentrated. They're regionally concentrated. My sense also is that they're concentrated within, if not sort of a bureaucratic, you know, sort of government business class, A, and then B, and then you can see this geographically. I mean, you could say, well, most Malians live in the south of the center, and so the gains really end up being concentrated in the opportunity areas that gather around Bamako, like Sikasso, like Kai in the west. There's a wide swath of people who aren't seeing those gains, who aren't seeing that growth.
That's Jonathan Sears, an assistant professor of international development studies at Menno Simons College in Winnipeg, Canada. He was speaking with VOA's William Eagle.
Fighting erupted in northern Cameroon last week between people displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency and villagers who have hosted them for the past 3 years. The clashes left several people dead in addition to property destroyed and cattle killed. The government is trying to negotiate an end to the crisis, but the host communities say their resources have been stretched thin. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from the northern village of Wak.
An uneasy calm reigns in Wak, a village in northern Cameroon, after clashes last week between residents and people displaced by Boko Haram left several people dead and 15 wounded. 64-year-old Hifbi Haman, leader of a community of internally displaced persons, says the conflict erupted when members of the host community beat their wives and chased them from farms they have occupied since 2015.
Ces femmes sont souvent des personnes déplacées, des réfugiés.
He says their wives, who are already suffering the most from Boko Haram atrocities, are still not finding peace in their host communities. They are exploited and sexually harassed just because they are vulnerable, he says. Among the wounded is 42-year-old Seydou Habiba, who says she escaped from her village in July after her family was targeted 3 times by Boko Haram fighters. She was saved by Cameroon's military.
J'ai quitté mon village et venu s'installer à Mba. Je n'ai plus les moyens. Nous voulons que...
Habiba says since war drove her from her northern village of Mozuku, she has not been able to find peace and she has no means of survival. She says all that she is asking for is a means to raise domestic animals or a farm to grow crops. The village of Wak has received more than 700 internally displaced people since 2015, when fighting between Cameroon's military and Boko Haram spiked on the border with Nigeria. Governor of the region, Kildadi Tagieke Bukar, visited the area Thursday in hopes of resolving the conflict between villagers and the IDPs. He declared the conflict a provocation by IDPs who occupied more land than they were given by their hosts.
Il y a un manque d'allégeance des populations déplacées vis-à-vis des chefs traditionnels, qu'il y a une destruction des arbres.
He says the recent bloody conflict was sparked by the refusal of internally displaced persons to obey instructions from traditional rulers not to illegally occupy host community farms, cattle ranches, and land reserves. Bukar says he has strongly instructed the IDPs to respect their hosts and for the host communities to learn to live in solidarity with the people displaced by Boko Haram. The United Nations says Boko Haram fighting has affected food security in parts of Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, and Niger, a major reason for the conflict between host communities and refugees. Cameroon's Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development says 2 million people in the country are at risk of food insecurity, 70% of them on its northern border with Nigeria. Raphael Ba is a Cameroon Red Cross official in the north. He says more funding is needed to assist host communities and refugees to prevent further conflict.
La première intervention, c'est cette distribution alimentaire qui va concerner.
He says the first and most important thing they have done for now to calm the conflict is providing 15,000 people with food aid. He says the second thing they will do to stop dependency on aid is to hand out planting seeds to host communities and IDPs to increase their production and to fight hunger and famine. Boko Haram has displaced nearly 250,000 Cameroonians through violence that began when the Nigerian Islamist group began using Cameroon for bases. Cameroon says it has only received 1/3 of the $690 million in aid required this year to meet the needs of displaced people and host communities. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, WAC, Northern Cameroon.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 19 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Nelson Chamisa's Zimbabwe Opposition MDC Alliance has filed a court challenge to the July 30th elections. In Mali, two veteran politicians face off in a runoff presidential election on Sunday, and the government in Cameroon is trying to negotiate an end to the crisis between peoples displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency and villagers who have hosted them for the last 3 years. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The leaders of a study by one of the world's leading HIV research institutions are hoping their results will transform strategies aimed at preventing new infections in Africa. The Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa, or CAPRISA, has shown how relationships between young women and men who are on average 9 years older are driving the HIV epidemic in the country and possibly on the continent. CAPRISA warns that infections will rise alarmingly unless prevention efforts focus on the age disparity. Darren Taylor reports in the final part of a series on this issue.
Heavy machinery helps to build a road in Vulindlela, a rural community in South Africa's KwaZulu-Natal province. It's an epicenter of the global HIV epidemic. One out of every four adults here is infected with the virus. The director of the Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa, or CAPRISA, Professor Salim Karim, says places like Vulindlela show HIV remains a disaster in the country.
Of the global HIV epidemic being in Southern Africa, 3 to 3.5 million new infections each day in Africa. And South Africa is the biggest contributor to those new infections.
Karim's fellow medical scientist, Professor Tulio da Oliveira, says it's time for a different approach, and that means directing efforts towards what he calls a special group infecting young women on the continent, men around 30 years of age.
That's normally when men think that they are invincible, yeah, and they don't really engage a lot on treatment or testing, yeah.
A CAPRISA study has revealed the cycle of HIV transmission by analyzing the genes of the HIV viruses of thousands of infected people in Vulindlela. It finds that men between the ages of 25 and 35 are the key infectors of younger women. The women who are mostly poor often get into relationships with men who can provide them with food and other basic necessities. These unemployed young men playing table soccer in a tavern in Vulindlela say it's difficult to get a girlfriend in the township if you don't have an income. Karim says as long as there's serious poverty and young women are in sexual relationships just for survival, HIV infection rates will continue to spike.
We have a situation where women have multiple partners. So they're not having more sex, they're just having different partners. And in a situation where you've got a high prevalence of HIV, you're more likely to come across somebody who's got HIV.
D'Oliveira says prevention resources must be used to educate the link that's been missed so far in the HIV transmission chain, the men in their mid-20s and 30s. But veteran HIV counsellor Getswana Mahlase doubts whether young men are willing to take the necessary steps. She's seen thousands of them in KwaZulu-Natal over the past few decades, like these youths singing before a football match, and she says they know what to do to prevent HIV, they just don't do it. Mahlase says there's little chance of condom usage becoming widespread in the areas in which she works. Men have all the power, she explains, and most men don't like to use condoms.
Or else the boy turns the things around and say, if you want me to use a condom, it means that you know that you are HIV positive and you do not want to give me HIV. So it becomes very nasty for the girls.
Another intervention that Caprice is pushing is a huge free rollout to young women of a pill that significantly reduces the possibility of contracting HIV. It's called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. If the pill is taken once a day for about a month prior to having sex, it can reduce the possibility of HIV infection by up to 90%. Mahla says she's doing her best to convince young women about the benefits of PrEP, mostly without success.
I ask them, like, why would you not use PrEP? Because maybe some boyfriend will think that I am cheating.
This is Bonga Musa Butelezi's office. He's the local Induna, or Zulu, chief. Butelezi says there's only one solution to the ever-increasing rates of HIV among young women in the area: employment. The chief says if the women have jobs, there'll be no need for them to get involved in dangerous relationships with older men. Mahlase lectures yet another group of young men about the dangers of not knowing their HIV status and then having relationships with girls as young as 15. They promise to be tested. They agree that such interactions are wrong. Later, Mahlase sighs and says some of the men who made the pretty promises will tomorrow be the same ones spreading HIV in the community. Yet in the midst of the desperation, there are positive signs. Growing numbers of young men in KwaZulu-Natal and elsewhere are getting medically circumcised, an effective way to reduce their chances of getting and transmitting HIV. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Vulindlela, South Africa.
Sudan's ruling National Congress Party has nominated President Omar al-Bashir to run again in 2020, even though it would violate the current two-term limit. The 74-year-old Bashir already has ruled the country for 29 years and previously said he would step down when his current term expires. A 1989 military coup first brought Bashir to power, and he has won 2 5-year terms since the country's new constitution took effect in 2010. The NCP revised the party's rules last night to drop a two-term limit and now will have to change the national constitution so Bashir can run again. The International Criminal Court has indicted Bashir for war crimes and crimes against humanity allegedly committed in Darfur in 2009. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Patrick Deo, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. This week, African elections, fallout from a narrow and disputed victory for ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe, and we preview what's at stake for the runoff election in Mali with J. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and John Tomaszewski, Africa director at the International Republican Institute. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Africa. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.